AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. A refinery held by the Islamic State group in Syria has gone up in flames after being hit by U.S.-led coalition warplanes today. One witness says the plant burned for a couple of hours after a series of explosions. A suspected U.S. drone strike has killed four suspected terrorists in northwestern Pakistan near the Afghan border. A mother and father and three of their children were found dead by their fourth child inside their home in Springville, Utah, yesterday. Police Lieutenant David Caron says the boy had arrived home with his grandparents.
It was all quiet in the house and thought that was unusual. He went around and looked and found his parents and the three siblings.
While tests did not find any carbon monoxide in the house, Caron says the doors were opened by the boy and his grandparents, so the house might have been vented. He adds autopsies should determine what killed the four family members. More trouble in Ferguson, Missouri. A police officer has been wounded after an encounter with two men at a closed community center last night.
And as he came into very close proximity with them, one of the individuals turned with a firearm. The officer was able to block it with his arm and then was shot in the arm by one of the suspects.
That's St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmer. The parents of Michael Brown, the black 18-year-old shot and killed by a white Ferguson police officer in August, are rejecting Police Chief Tom Jackson's apology, demanding that he be fired. And the police officer charged with murder, Michael Brown, Sr.
The apology will be when Darren Wilson has handcuffs, processed, and charged with murder.
Air France's pilots union has announced an end to its 14-day strike that grounded roughly half of the airline's flights and stranded passengers around the world. This is AP Radio News. An American doctor exposed to Ebola in Africa should soon be in the U.S. for treatment. R. Ed Donahue tells us more.
The doctor was exposed to Ebola while volunteering in Sierra Leone. Treatment will be in a special isolation unit at the National Institutes of Health Hospital near Washington, D.C., NIH Infectious Disease Chief Dr. Anthony Fauci says just because the doctor was exposed to Ebola, it doesn't mean that the person will become sick. They just want to put them in the best possible situation if something happens. Four other American aid workers were infected with Ebola in West Africa. One is still in the hospital. The others have recovered. Ed Donahue, Washington.
6 months into the world's worst Ebola outbreak, and officials in West Africa say there is still a huge gap between what is needed and what's been provided. Doctors, beds, all sorts of medical equipment and supplies in short supply. More than 3,000 people are thought to have died in that outbreak. I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Green light. Hey, girl. School zone. I'm getting hungry. Car changing lanes. You want to meet me for pizza? Stop sign. Intersection clear. Yeah, street. Pizza sounds good. Ball in street? Girl in street!
It's hard to concentrate on two things at once, like texting and driving. Stop the text. Stop the wrecks. How will you stop texting and driving? Tell us at stoptextstoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The federal government produces massive amounts of information every day, but most of it's useless beyond the agency that produces it because it's not available in a usable format. That's starting to change. With the passage of the Data Act, the first steps have been taken. But what's next? Join the Data Transparency Coalition and Workiva September 30th for Data Transparency 2014, the preeminent gathering of leaders from Congress, the executive branch, and industry to find out what's next for data transparency and open data. Register today at datatransparency2014.org.
The traditional light bulb, a groundbreaking invention in 1879. It's time we switched to longer-lasting Energy Star light bulbs. They're more efficient than the old bulbs, like a text message is more efficient than a carrier pigeon. And they cut down on our energy costs. Because in our own groundbreaking age, we deserve a light bulb that saves us some cash. Saving energy saves you money. Learn more at energysavers.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Tyson's Corner office of Offutt Corman. This is your host, Colin Callahan. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today. First, we have Jonathan Cogley, who is the CEO of Thycotic. Then we have Larry Beebe, who is principal of Bond Beebe. And then Dr. Celis Lambert Woolard, who is the president and CEO of Pathway Homes. And finally, John Nolan, who's the president of Quadell Consulting. But first up, we have Jonathan Cogley, who is CEO of Thycotic. Welcome, Jonathan. And what is Thycotic?
So Thycotic is an IT security company that provides software tools to IT departments all over the world to solve problems mostly around passwords.
Mm-hmm.
So just dealing with infrastructure, and if you think about how many passwords you have as an individual, and then think about IT groups and the same problems they have, we basically make software to help with those those issues.
And how large or small is Thycotic?
Thycotic's just under 50 employees, and we're on target to do $10 million in revenue in 2014.
Great. So how did you get a job with this company?
Well, it was really easy. I founded the company, but I founded it back in 1996, and the early days were all consulting-based. So it was myself as an independent contractor doing consulting, and then really only turned it into a larger venture and started hiring other people in 2003, 2004.
So what shifted for you in 2004 that you decided to grow the business in a different way?
It was really the next evolution. I think the early years were really just about me understanding how I could provide services to customers, and getting my skills honed and understanding the industry a bit better. And then the next step for me was, well, this is great, but how do I scale the business? How do I do the next thing? I can only do so much as an individual. If I bring more, you know, similar-minded folks on board, then maybe we can do bigger things.
What was the what was the biggest surprise when you shifted from working basically as a solo person to all of a sudden having to manage people?
Definitely a much bigger time commitment. So I know in the early years, I used to joke I would have sort of a 40-hour a week job working with customers and helping solve problems, and then I might have another 20 to 40 hours trying to manage the business and the people. So yeah, just a huge volume of work in the early years.
And what steps did you take to change that?
So one of the things that we identified, so we were consulting based doing software engineering, and we identified that to really scale the business to the next level, we needed to go to product. And so if we could start generating revenue from software products, we'd be able to scale with less people, which means I'd have less of that time in the evenings to try to manage, you know, less people, make it a bit easier. So that was a big transition for us, that we started down that road in 2005. And we started using some of the folks we had to start building software product. And so we've really converted the company from a services company to a product company, and made the complete transition around about 2010.
So where did you grow up? Where were you born and raised?
Grew up in South Africa, so Johannesburg. Went to school, did my undergraduate there.
And then you said that around college you moved in the green room. You told us that you had moved to the UK.
I did, yeah. So when I finished up college, I moved to the UK. I lived there for a couple of years, and that's where I actually started the consulting. So my timing was great. I was right there in the late 90s, so the internet was just starting to take hold. And there were e-commerce companies popping up. Everyone needed a website, and they were even starting to say, well, can we do personalization? Can we do bigger and better things online? And so I sort of rode that early wave of the internet in the late 90s, and started, you know, building the business from there.
And how young were you when you had your first job?
Wow, my first job would have been back as a teenager. So I remember working in retail. So working in retail stores, packing shelves, that kind of thing. And I had a job for probably from like junior high onwards, always working, you know, every weekend, every second weekend.
What'd you do with the money?
I used to save up for different things. So I'd have my wish list of things that I wanted to get, and I would you know, work on that. I think it really instilled in me this a strong work ethic that you don't just get things, you've got to put in the effort and plan for it.
What were your mom and dad doing when you were growing up?
So my mom has worked on and off as a realtor over the years. So to help the family out with additional money when she was able to, that kind of thing. And my dad worked for different large engineering firms. And he actually, I think it influenced me at some level. He actually started his own business in his later years. So when I was in high school and college, he was running his own company, a small business. So definitely got some of my entrepreneurial ideas from dad.
Was it the kind of business that he was able to use your help, even filing or that sort of thing? Or did you just saw it at the dinner table?
It was really just the dinner table and just how he did business, and he talked a lot about it. Back in those days, it was pretty common to entertain business at home. So I would often get to meet, and he did a lot of international business. So I'd get to meet some really interesting people from all over the world that would be in South Africa to do business with him. So it was just something I kind of got used to, that was apparently the norm.
And it isn't for a lot of people, but so that was just part of the exposure that you had. Do you think that's given you a facility today in business, that having that exposure as a kid?
I think so. I think the entrepreneurial tendency, I think, set in pretty young. So I had that working, you know, just in retail in high school. I took the same thing when I was in college. So I did tutoring. So I really enjoyed tutoring, mostly high school students. I would help them primarily with math. And I did a similar thing there. I started out working for a tutoring company for about 6 months and then looked at it and said, this doesn't make sense. Why don't I just work for myself and build my own business around this? And I continued and did that for another 2.5 years after it.
Have you always had that independent streak working for yourself?
I think so. I think it's being able to kind of decide my own destiny and then also seeing the results. So if I work hard and do something well, then I can see the benefit of that. So that's something that's carried through. And I did the same thing when I moved to the UK in later years. I didn't really consider taking full-time jobs at other companies. I was always looking at lots of different ventures. One thing I can say is I've tried so many things over the years that failed. I'm very, very familiar with failure. But, you know, with lots of failure, every now and then comes a success.
What was one of your first failures, and how did you respond to it?
Gosh, got to try to pick one. There's been so many to choose from. Let's see, one of the early ones that I did, I remember when I first moved to the UK, I got involved with, it was, again, the internet was becoming big. I looked at tourism within the city that I was living in. And so I built an online presence for the city. I got involved with some of the folks within the city. I even got the mayor to the launch of the online presence. I never generated any money. It was pretty interesting and a fun learning experience, but certainly wasn't a success in any monetary form.
So there were lessons that you took away from it, though. So that's where you sort of picked up, dusted yourself off, and took the lessons. Is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. I think every failure is just an opportunity to learn something. And you have to look at those and then, you know, get better the next time. And it might still fail, but hopefully it'll be a little bit better than it was the previous.
You had described yourself as a little bit soft-spoken and introvert. Was it a challenge reaching out, like in the tourism and reaching out to people, or is that...
It is. It's. I've tried to do similar things there too. So it's become very apparent to me the further I get in my career that being able to speak and do public speaking is an enormous asset. So I've worked very hard at that and forced myself into those situations time and time again. And as with almost everything in life, I mean, the more you practice something, the better you get at it. And I think introverts can pretend to be extroverts if they're given enough practice. And, you know, if the situation calls for it, you do what you need to do.
And enough time to recover afterwards,
Exactly. although with more and more practice, the nerves kind of go away and you kind of get a little bit more comfortable with it.
Well, and it strikes me too, as I'm talking with you, that the mentoring and the personal relationships, you actually get a lot of energy and strength from. So the mentoring piece of it makes it so it's not so hard when you're doing the marketing piece of it or the presentation piece.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, mentoring, seeing success through others is just magic.
I mean,
that's a very fulfilling thing, which can be hard in business, right? Because we don't always have, you know, the fantastic mission behind us or something like that. We have to find success in, you know, the almighty dollar just bringing in more revenue or something. But if you can see people growing in their skills within your team and achieving bigger and better things, and you can see that you are a part of that, it's enormously satisfying.
Well, that was going to be my next question, is what's the most fun about running your business now that it's got more people in it?
One of the really things I've started to enjoy just in the last, and it's really become apparent in the last 3 to 6 months, is I've been able to get more and more out of the operations side of the just the running, the day-to-day of the business, and starting to get a bit more strategic. And we were never VC funded or got any, you know, any sort of backing to the company. It was all completely bootstrapped, which means that the early years were, I was heavily, heavily involved in operations. And this is just amazing now. All of a sudden, people are dealing with all the fires and anything that's going on. They've got it handled. And I can focus more on where do we want to go? What's the strategy? What metrics do we need? Where should we be in 2 to 3 years' time?
So you'd mentioned that you have children again in the green room. You told us this. How is being a CEO like being a father?
Oh, wow. This is dangerous territory. It is something that you can talk about. There are parallels. I would never want to infer that employees are like children.
No.
But there's definitely parallels. I think the motivations are similar. Children, of course, are a lot easier to manipulate. ideally, employees. I think if you give them the right things, if you give people in general just the ability to control their own destiny, you give them the resources, the leeway that they need, and then you coach and mentor them, even if it's not you directly, give them the tools or the other people to coach and help them. With the right people, success is almost inevitable.
Great. So, Jonathan, what's the website?
So, Thycotic is thycotic.com. So, it's thycotic.com.
Great, thank you. We've been speaking with Jonathan Cogley, who is the CEO of Thycotic. Don't forget to check out our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is Dr. Shirley Davis, President and CEO, The Success Doctor. Welcome, Shirley. Shirley, what's The Success Doctor all about?
It's a global workforce and talent management consulting organization. What we do is track trends, and we identify best practices and strategies for organizations around the world of all sizes, all industries, and help them understand how to get great talent, how to keep it, and how to make sure that they get the most out of
it. And what's your role in the company?
My role is president and CEO, and I actually do a lot of the coaching and speaking and consulting.
And what do you like most about that?
Absolutely love the strategy development and helping to get leaders to that aha moment.
And what makes the organization so special, in your view?
Capturing a lot of the great best practices that we've been able to do. And I think, you know, my brand, I build great relationships and I provide them what they need instead of what I want them to have.
And what do you think the clients appreciate most about you and your company?
I make the strategies, even though they're global, I make them very, very customized and practical.
And who, in your view, is the ideal client, the perfect client?
The perfect client is one that has a need, and the perfect client is one that can recognize that there is an opportunity with the strategies that we provide for them to make their organizations better.
And what do you personally enjoy most about the work?
I love seeing the strategies come to life. I love seeing the impact and the results that come as a result of it. And I love when they call me back and thank me because they've seen change.
That's excellent. And what's the website for the company?
DrShirleyDavis.com. That's www.drshirleydavis.com.
Thank you, Shirley. We've been speaking with Dr. Shirley Davis, President and CEO, The Success Doctor. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Colin Callahan. It's now my pleasure to introduce Larry Beebe, who is the principal of Bond Beebe.
Welcome, Larry. And what is Bond BB?
Bond BB is an all-purpose CPA firm located in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan offices. We have offices in Bethesda, Maryland, and in Alexandria, Virginia.
Uh-huh. And how large or small is the firm?
The firm has about 80 people in total.
Uh-huh. And how long has it been in existence?
The firm's been in existence since 1932.
Uh-huh. Well, you look like a fairly young man.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm not the BB in the firm name. My father was the BB in the firm name. My father joined Mr. Bond in 1937. Mr. Bond founded the firm in 32. Mr. Bond's two sons came after the war, so the firm name at one point in time was Bond, BB, Bond, and Bond.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a second-generation piece to this, but it's not a family firm, you said.
No, it's not a family firm at all. I'm one of 13 partners in the firm, and all the equity partners in the firm are equal equity owners. Yeah. So I'm just one of the group, so to speak.
And do you have specialties?
Yeah, our big specialty is labor and employee benefit plans. That probably represents 50% of our practice or more. But we also have specialties in income tax and in small business, particularly in construction and real estate.
Mm-hmm. How young were you when you first realized that you had a knack for the accounting?
Well, that's an interesting story because it really came about when I was a freshman in college.
Uh-huh.
And I took my first accounting class because I was good at math, not because I was interested in accounting.
Yeah.
But I took the first accounting class and they gave the first exam. When the professor gave the papers back, I got 100 on the exam. And it floored me because everybody else around me was getting 30s and 40s on the exam. And I thought, boy, I must have a knack for this. And a lot of people think that my father drove me into accounting, but it's not true at all. Mm-hmm. It came about because I just seemed to have a natural knack for it.
Mm-hmm. And so part of it was your math skills.
Yeah, it really was. But I found out through college that I didn't really have any really advanced math skills. I struggled with things like calculus and things like that. So I learned I better go with the simpler stuff, which was accounting.
And whereabouts did you grow up?
I actually was born in Washington, D.C. I'm pretty unique that way. I'm from Washington, but I grew up in Kensington, Maryland, a suburb of Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh. And did you do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have a brother and two sisters. I'm the oldest of four.
Uh-huh. So what's true about the oldest child in the overall family dynamic?
Well, I think the oldest child always sets the stage. I think a lot is expected of the oldest child.
Uh-huh.
And I think my father expected an awful lot of me. My brother was a good athlete. So I wasn't the one who was going to be that way, but I had to succeed in something, and as it turned out, it was accounting.
Uh-huh. And when you came out of college, did you end up interning or working right away with your father's firm, or did you work other places?
Yeah, in fact, I actually interned with my father's firm in my junior and senior year and found a couple of mentors within the firm, young guys that I really related to. And unfortunately, after graduating at the University of Maryland, I had to take a 3.5-year detour into the U.S. Air Force. I was an internal auditor. I flew a desk.
Uh-huh.
And I came right back to the firm, and I've been there ever since.
So there's a lot of longevity. There's a real belief in what you do.
If I make it the next September 1st, I'll have been with the firm 50 years.
Wow. That's pretty impressive in this day and age.
Well, it may be, but we have a lot of people. We probably have 30 or more people who've been with the firm 10 years or more, and that's good.
Yeah. What do you think is the culture, the character of the firm that creates that kind of longevity and people
want
to stay there?
Well, I think we're a very caring firm. We're very supportive of one another. Everybody in the firm seems to be willing to do any job. I think our managing partner, Dave Dorsey, would empty the trash cans if you ask him to empty the trash cans. Uh-huh. And I think we all feel that way.
Yeah.
I think it creates almost a family atmosphere that everybody feels really comfortable in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did your mom was a stay-at-home mom?
Stay-at-home mom,
And what did you learn from her that shows up in your management and practice style today?
I think I learned patience from her as much as I learned anything. She was a very She was a very caring individual. I'm sorry she didn't really meet her grandkids because she died relatively young. But I think she gave me the skill to, in effect, sit back and take things in and not really get too riled about anything.
And what about your dad? What sort of leadership qualities did you get from your dad?
Pop was a real entrepreneur. He was a farm kid from Iowa. Came to school when he was six. Came to Washington D.C. when he was 16 to live with his uncle and go through the University of Maryland. And he had a driving spirit. Unfortunately, accounting was not an area in which his entrepreneur skills showed very much. Early on, although they did later on. He always said, I helped other people become millionaires. And that, he thought that was his one real skill.
Not a bad one to have.
No.
excuse me. You said also that as a kid you used to visit your grandparents.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually worked on the farm in the summer for 4 years, the 4 years that I went to college. And I picked sweet corn and delivered sweet corn to stores all over southeastern Iowa, and I realized that's not what I wanted to do for a living. My uncle out there was quite an entrepreneur in his own way, and he was a good mentor for me during those 4 years, but that's not what I wanted to do.
Right. Aside from not picking the sweet corn, what else do you think you learned that shows up today and influences you today?
Well, I think just the almost everybody that was one of my mentors and what have you challenged me in terms of hard work. You know, I never thought I was the smartest kid in the world, but I thought if I'm going to make it in life, I'm going to outwork everybody. And, you know, that's a hard statement to make, but you know, I think I combined ultimately the smartness with the hard work, and
right.
I think it all paid off.
Right. So you just kept focused on that, and the success came.
Yeah.
You also shared a story that came to you fairly later in your career that kind of was a shift.
Yeah. In 1997, we had a partner who specialized in employee benefit plans, and he died quite suddenly. Uh-huh. He was 49 years old, had lung cancer, and went quickly. At the time, I was one of the old generalists in the firm. I didn't really have a specialty. Uh-huh. I did a lot of income tax. I did a lot of audits for construction companies and so forth. I had one big employee benefit client, but it wasn't really my specialty. But when this partner, Tom Say, died, all of a sudden I got thrust into taking over a lot of his clients, which were in the employee benefits area. And I wasn't really sure that I could succeed in that area because it was a lot different than what I'd already done. Mm. But with the help of Dave Dorsey and some of the other people in the firm, I think we pulled it off. And I think Tom would be really proud of the fact that we really took what was a growing niche and made it very, very successful.
Mm-hmm. And that was, as you said, sort of later in your career.
Yeah, I actually was 53 years old when that happened. And, you know, so it was relatively late in my career, but it really, within the next 10 years, I think I became one of the real leaders of the firm, whereas before that, I was a successful partner, but I wasn't thought of as being one of the top leaders of the firm.
And how about your role now? You mentioned that there's kind of the
My role now has changed a lot. When I was 63 years old, and I'm 71 now, I gave up leadership in the firm in terms of being on the executive committee and so forth because I really believe that the younger people ought to run the firm. That's the way it really should be. And so I've taken the role more of being the teacher, the mentor, the person that the firm can count on to do almost anything that they need me to do. So I do a lot of writing, a lot of speaking, a lot of public relations stuff for the firm, and I think it's worked out really well.
Yeah. So perseverance is kind of the main message, right?
Perseverance. You know, I really think if you look at it over that length of a career, yes, perseverance is the word.
Yeah, great. Well, Larry, what is the website for Bond BB?
The website for Bond BB is bondbbpc.com.
Great. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining me for this segment is Doug Kay, who is a principal with a firm called Offutt Kerman. What is Offutt Kerman, Doug?
Offutt Kerman is a full-service law firm in the Mid-Atlantic region with offices from Philadelphia all the way down to Tyson's Corner, Virginia, where I work.
Right. And you're a lawyer with the firm?
I'm a lawyer with the firm.
What practice area do you specialize in?
I mostly do work in commercial litigation, although I also do work in doing criminal defense and personal injury, anything that gets me to trial.
Anything that gets you to trial. Well, why do your customers appreciate you?
I think they appreciate me because I am a careful and sympathetic listener, and I try to offer concrete solutions to their most vexing legal problems.
Well, give us an example. Do you have, without mentioning specifics, a recent example of where you were really good at this? How about your favorite client up till now, without getting into two particulars there?
Well, I represented a fellow who was in a commercial lease, and the landlord was determined to make him pay more than he should have been paying. And we had to go to court, and we had to go all the way through trial, and the client really appreciated the effort, and we got an excellent result for the client. And that was very satisfying, and since then he's been talking me up all over town, so I can't thank him enough.
Yeah. What's the best part of practicing law for you?
I would say that it is taking people through difficult circumstances when they think they don't have any options and trying to find a good solution for them.
Right. What's the website address for the law firm?
www.offuttkerman.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Doug Kay, who's the principal with Offutt Kerman. This is Peter Schwartz, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Colin Callahan, and it's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Celissa Lambert Woodard, who is the president and CEO of Pathway Homes. Welcome, Dr. Woodard. And
thank you. Thank
and
you for
also,
having me.
Yes. And also, I'd like to ask you, what is Pathway Homes?
Oh, Pathway Homes is a private nonprofit organization providing non-time-limited housing and supportive services to individuals with serious mental illness, mm-hmm. intellectual disabilities, and substance use disorders, and a combination or co-occurring nature of both of those disorders, or all three of those disorders. Mm-hmm. The organization is one that is based in a strong belief that housing is a right, not mm-hmm. a privilege, mm-hmm. and that individuals with mental illness can and do recover. Mm-hmm. Pathways was actually founded in 1980, okay. so we're celebrating 34 years worth of productivity. Uh-huh. And in fact, just this past year, we were named the 2013 Best Housing Program with mm-hmm. the Governor's Award in Virginia.
Wow.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Good work. Now, when you've been with the firm for how long?
I've been with Pathways for 15 years.
Uh-huh. And when you came in, did you come in as president and CEO? Or?
No, I didn't. In fact, I came in after the previous board was undergoing a succession planning mm-hmm. Exercise, and they were looking at recruiting individuals in the community. So I came into Pathway Homes as Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer.
Uh-huh. And then moved your way into,
yes.
over time, graduated up into being the full CEO and
absolutely.
Running that side.
When the previous CEO retired, I moved into the president and CEO position. I've been in that position a little over 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And what is most rewarding about your day-to-day work with Pathway Homes?
You know, I think that what's incredibly rewarding is the investment that we have in the individuals in the community who have such a significant need. It's empowering and providing a sense of hope for individuals who otherwise would not have it by creating opportunities through housing and supports for them to be able to attend to the key components of their recovery, housing, which is essential in being able to allow a person to be able to think about taking their medications and receiving the services that allow them to be able to thrive. The support services that we're providing at the quality level, providing assistance with both therapy and counseling, medical health care components, these are all essential components that allow individuals to reach ultimately their dreams in life, to re-enter society, to be employable, to be constituents, to be active uh-huh. and productive citizens.
So
You'd said in the green room that you grew up in Culpeper.
Yes, yes.
How young were you when you realized that you had this interest in social support?
Well, it wasn't at a very young age, actually. It was not automatic. I think it was definitely more instinctual. In fact, I didn't know that I would end up in this field. Uh-huh. As I was growing up, my family was such that oftentimes on Sundays after church, we would have Sunday dinner. Uh-huh. And so there'd be a number of individuals around the table that I would affectionately call auntie or unks, mm-hmm. And they would be of no blood relation to me at all. Mm-hmm. But these were individuals oftentimes who had come upon hard times in their life, needed transitional supports, mm-hmm. Family in a very natural way. So many individuals lived with us for mm-hmm. periods of time. It was kind of a natural group home of
right.
sort. That was the approach that we had, my parents had, in terms of the care for others. And so oftentimes it meant a bit of sacrifice, mm-hmm. Maybe not necessarily having the same room or, or things of that nature. And so by the time actually I was ready to transition to college, I was pretty much so through with being, the loving family member uh-huh. and sacrificing for the good of all. And so, I had some previous years in Marine Corps ROTC, JROTC, et cetera, uh-huh. and business. And so I decided to definitely go off to pursue either a military career or a career in business.
Uh-huh.
And so the time or the age that I became aware that this was something that was a passion of mine actually mm-hmm. came about when I was trying to avoid a math class in my junior year.
Uh-huh.
And so I took a couple of psychology and social work classes and had this incredible internship working in an intensive group home and affiliating with psychiatric hospitals in the community. And it was that experience that resonated with me as an individual.
Yeah.
It was instinctual, uh-huh. and all of that history from the past really made sense for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And from that point on, I was very committed in developing this not only as a career, but it's something that I would be doing if I were not certainly paid to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
It's such a clear case of early influence and exposure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then without really even looking for it, you stumble across it and you've got that internal resonance.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
And did you have brothers or sisters?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
I am the youngest of two girls.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And what's true about being the youngest?
You know, I think that being the youngest afforded me the ability to be a systems designer. In other words,
uh-huh.
Understanding the systems from those individuals, learning from those who are older from me and seeing what works in the family allowed me to integrate and inspire others to meet my needs as the youngest. And so oftentimes I had the opportunity to do some exceptional things through childhood. By watching others and understand the dynamics of the family that had I not been the youngest, I wouldn't have been afforded to do.
Right. It's as a fellow youngest, I understand.
Yes.
What were your mom and dad doing?
My mom and dad were and are absolutely incredible. My dad and mom were both working class
mm-hmm.
Members of society.
Uh-huh.
My father retired after 30 years of work with a major electric company.
Uh-huh.
And my mother also, I consider her an absolute domestic goddess. She's a homemaker, taught for a number of years in elementary school. But I think they also both were incredible in regards to how they interacted with the community.
Uh-huh.
My father was an entrepreneur, most definitely. He always had a number of projects or side jobs
right.
That he was involved in.
And you got to go along.
I was the tag-along, yes. I was the tag-along. I would wherever my dad went, I would follow. If he was at the local Optimist Club, I was there trying to get an oratorical contest or just following through. If he was at the nursing home or at a hospital, I would go with him. If he was looking at multi-level marketing opportunities. Uh-huh. I would go along and hear the inspirational speeches of uh-huh. those who had been successful. And likewise, we did some incredible things. He had a sideline business of cleaning. We could clean uh-huh. Law offices. And I cannot tell you how many interesting reads you can have when you're involved as a tag-along uh-huh. in law firms. And at one point, I had thought about actually going into that field. Uh-huh. So, yeah, just a wonderful amount of exposure.
Right.
Because he had such an incredible work ethic, it really helped me become a lifelong learner and also being invested in becoming more entrepreneurial myself.
Mm-hmm. What and from your mom, what shows up in your day-to-day leadership skills or style that you got from your mom?
You know, my mom was beautifully strategic. She was like a generational developer is uh-huh. what I'll call her. You know, she had a tremendous spiritual gift of service and caretaking. She had incredible patience, and she was so giving, and she is. She's one of the most, I don't know of anyone who sacrifices mm-hmm. The way she has throughout her life for the good of her family, and she has truly touched generations within our family system.
Yeah, it sounds that she's had a great influence, sounds
yeah.
like it.
Yeah, both my parents are just wonderful.
Yeah. So how does that show up in your day-to-day running of Pathway Homes?
You know, I think from my father, I certainly take the kind of strategic approach uh-huh. of looking for opportunities and creating and dreaming about what can be. And certainly the work ethic has impacted me tremendously. My husband and I also, in addition to Pathways, own private practices, mm-hmm. Alliance Therapy Center throughout Virginia. And so we're committed to advancing what we're doing as individuals mm-hmm. To be able to impact the larger community.
So always looking to strive to touch more.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Right, absolutely. And with my mother, I think the takeaway certainly was the investment in the individual. Mm-hmm. How important it is to remember the importance of each person
right.
you touch, no matter how large, making sure that person, I think it's so important that when you're providing direction or leadership, it's oftentimes how a person feels more so than what you say to them that's most impactful, and recognizing the importance of that caring, that genuine, that authentic investment that you must have in a person to yeah. impact yeah. Their motivation and willingness uh-huh. to be able to continue to do the work.
What does the public need to know about this intersection between sort of housing first and mental health?
Absolutely, it's a great question. You know, housing first, the philosophy means that there's housing non-contingent upon services, so that individuals, irregardless of where they are, if they're chronically homeless, if they are struggling with the symptoms of their mental illness, if they are currently actively utilizing or using substances, illicit or not, that irregardless of where they are, housing has to be the foundation for recovery. If you or I are unhoused, if we're in the rain, in the elements, it's very difficult about being able to think about taking our medications mm-hmm. and the things that are necessary Great. To help us in recovery.
Great. Thank you so much. What's the website for Pathway Homes?
The website for Pathways is www.pathwayhomes.org.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. And we'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Les Smolin with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is Mark Cohn, founder of Cohn and Burnett, a law firm. Mark, welcome. What is Cohn and Burnett?
We are a law firm that focuses on trusts and estates. So we do wills, trusts, powers of attorney, estate planning, and estate administration.
And what's your role in the company?
I'm the founder and the senior partner.
So what does it mean to be a senior partner?
Well, it means that in our case, I'm the thought leader, the visionary, the one who tries to figure out where we're headed. I'm not the managing partner who runs the day-to-day operations.
Okay, and what makes Cohn and Burnett so special?
We are, first of all, focused on taking care of our clients and just on their estate planning and administration. and I think we're one of the first firms in the area to introduce a fixed fee for doing estate planning.
Interesting. And what do they really appreciate about you and the company, your clients, that is?
You know, the clients tell me that they just love the experience. They are very comfortable and confident that their needs are being met here, and they enjoy working with us.
Hmm. And who or what is your perfect client, if you will?
Our perfect client is anybody who cares about what's going to happen to them when they can no longer take care of themselves or their family.
Mm-hmm. And what is it you actually enjoy most about the work?
You know, talking to the clients, that's the part. I could turn over all of the work to other attorneys here, but I hold on to the first part, which is meeting the clients, talking to them, getting to know them, getting to understand where they're, what they need and what they're looking for.
That's great. What's the website for Cohen & Burnett?
CohenAndBurnett.com, all spelled out, the A-N-D in between there.
Thank you, Mark. We've been speaking with Mark Cohen, founder of Cohen & Burnett. This is Les Smolin, and that's been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Colin Callahan, and now it's my pleasure to introduce John Nolan, who is the president of Quadell Consulting.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, John. And what is Quadell Consulting?
Quadell Consulting is a consulting, training, and outsource management company based in D.C., that works with various governments on affordable housing-related programs.
Mm-hmm. And is this a profit or nonprofit?
It's a for-profit, private equity-owned company.
Uh-huh. And how did you get a job with this company?
I was with MCI for 15 years in finance roles, and after the private equity company purchased Quadell, they were looking to bring in a CFO, and I was lucky enough to be chosen for that role. Mm-hmm. And that was in 2006.
Mm-hmm. Great. And what about the day-to-day work is most exciting for you?
About the day-to-day work, the work we do, being that it's in affordable housing, all ends up helping somebody at the end of the day.
Uh-huh.
And it's usually a night in a safe, sanitary place. So finding a way to make the customer experience for those clients who use the housing plus the landlords who provide the housing, mm-hmm. providing good customer, good compliance service to both those sets of people ends in a very virtuous place with the people getting extra housing.
Uh-huh. Well, that's pretty uplifting. Great. How young were you when you realized that you liked to solve problems?
We had a pretty active household growing up, and we played a lot of games, and we liked competing with each other in various kind of games, and it was fun and challenging, and that sort of combination of problems and challenging and fun and working with other people to do that uh-huh. has always interested me.
Sort of the strategy games.
Strategy, but not just tactics and just being and just fun and uh-huh. trying to figure out how to do something better.
Mm-hmm. Well, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Dallas, Texas.
Uh-huh. And what were your mom and dad doing?
My mom was taking care of all the kids. There was two brothers and three sisters.
Uh-huh.
And my dad founded and ran a couple of telecom equipment companies.
Uh-huh. And so he was a bit entrepreneurial.
He was quite entrepreneurial. And yes, he was. He was one of the kind of the founders of how to do those sort of things and really grew up in that sort of first wave of telecom tech.
Uh-huh. And did you have an opportunity to, as a kid growing up, did you have an opportunity to go to work with him and get exposure that way? Or
a little bit every now and then. He actually kind of liked to keep me. He talked about some of it at home and more seeing customers, and I'd meet customers every once in a while, or I got to see him at road shows and investor relations. But he more kept them separate, typically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How young were you when you got your first job and made some money?
My first job where I made money, actually, I was 14,
uh-huh.
And I was actually selling flowers on a corner.
Uh-huh.
There was a couple who had a business model where, and because I talked to the guy, I was interested in business models even at that time.
Yeah.
And he said he gave a third to the sellers, kept a third for himself, and a third went to cover expenses.
Uh-huh.
And I bought my first stereo with the earnings from that season up to Mother's Day.
Uh-huh. And whose idea was it to get the job?
My mother actually had seen it in the paper and said, you might be good at this.
Uh-huh. And off you went.
Off I went.
What did you learn from that first job that still shows up today?
One of the things was that it's okay to stand your ground sometimes. Uh-huh. We actually, the way those things work is you have a license, a permit from the city to work on a certain corner.
Uh-huh.
I showed up my corner one time and someone else was there.
Uh-huh.
I was supposed to be on the northwest corner. He was supposed to be on the southeast corner. And I said, you need to move. And not in a conflicting way. And he moved. I showed him the conflict. So you have to stand your ground and you have to do what's right.
Uh-huh. That's a pretty big lesson to learn at 14. He moved, I take it.
He did.
when did you first realize that you wanted to get into finance as a path?
It was late. It was in college when I took some courses, and it intrigued me, the way the different components work together, that it was modeling a company in terms of all its moving parts and how they interrelate to each other, I found fascinating.
Uh-huh. And this was in college?
In college.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it sounds a little, the way you're holding your hands on the table here is a little bit like a board game, like Stratego or
That's
something.
That's interesting. I mean, it was, and it's just how systems relate to each other has always been fascinating to me, and business models,
uh-huh.
and trying to find ways for things to work together in a better way to deliver a better result.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to your brothers and sisters, you're the middle child.
I am.
Is that sort of put you in the pivot role and the balancing and that sort of thing?
Or? You learn in such a big family, and we have such a big extended family that you try doing a little balancing over time and family dynamics, and you sort of have people say cut that out, and you try to change your role. So.
And your brothers and you are still close.
Yes, we are very close. And I see my sisters, too. So, with my brothers, one runs a hospital, one has his own commercial real estate business in Texas. We get to bounce ideas off each other on business and sort of talk about moves with each other.
Uh-huh. And I think you said in the green room they were a little like you were each other's board of directors.
Exactly.
It's all those days over Monopoly. Also, there was something you said in the green room about approaching life and work with a sense of play. Can you speak about that?
Yeah, and I mean, so that goes back to my dad. I mean, my dad had this unbounding optimism, and you've got to kind of figure out what the good is. And one of his big sayings was, "If you can't fix it, feature it." And so, which actually relates back to a piece of equipment he delivered, which couldn't count something,
uh-huh.
which he would get charged on as part of the lease. It was part of the lease. It was straight up, and part was based on volume. And the thing that measured the volume wasn't working on the switch. So he gave the first 3 months of that away for free.
And made it a feature.
So he featured it.
Well, there's certainly a sense of play in that. I'm struck by the sense of family and growing up in the big family and that. How does that show up in your leadership and the culture that you develop at Quidel?
Yeah, I try at Quidel to listen a lot. And I said that's really what my mother does very well, is
uh-huh.
listen and be an enthusiastic supporter, but not have all the answers. Mm-hmm. And that's big. That was also my dad was big on that. I mean, you'd ask him for a big decision, and he was most likely to say, I'm sure you'll make the right decision.
And that carries.
And I tried, and I because I don't know. I mean, I have a lot of people who work for me who know more about the programs than I do because they're the experts, and it's really working with them to get the best out of them is what I do.
Yeah,
and which is really how I was raised.
What's important about affordable housing? Just for a quick second,
affordable housing is extremely important, and it's actually been. Like a lot of social services, underfunded in the country. And we've done work not just in ongoing affordable housing in large metropolitan areas such as Baltimore, Memphis, Chicago, Miami, but we've also done work on, a lot of people may not realize that the money to rebuild homes post a disaster comes through HUD.
Uh-huh.
And we've done significant work related to Katrina and Sandy.
Uh-huh.
So rebuilding, it's really about, it's the foundation upon which everybody, I mean, no pun intended,
yeah,
but I
yeah.
mean, if you don't have an address, you can't get a job because you don't know where to send the, you know, I mean, it's so foundational to everything.
Right, right.
To have a place to live.
And there is this sense of housing first coming along too, that getting people in a safe home.
Yes.
Is where they can build a meaningful business.
Absolutely.
And a meaningful life. Did you have other mentors besides your mom and dad along the way?
Yeah, I've been incredibly fortunate in my career. The CFO and the CEO of a division I worked at MCI were hugely influential. I've had great managers that, you know, did things like talk me into moving from having a job where I managed people to becoming an analyst so that I could learn about a new area and then take off in a different direction in mm-hmm. my career at MCI.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had people, because I sought them out, I listened to them, I thought about what they had, and I didn't always do exactly what they said, but I certainly always weighted heavily in my decisions.
Right.
And they knew that. And
right.
But the first of all was I performed well enough to get on people's maps,
yeah.
which is actually what you have to do.
That's good advice. Is your dad aware of your success?
Yeah. I mean, dad passed away.
Sorry.
Yeah, decade ago, and yeah, he was, you know, but I mean, I was vice president of MCI, so yes, I'd done.
Yeah,
he was aware, and we were great friends, and enjoyed each other's company yeah. immensely.
Great, great. What's the website for Quadel?
The website is quadel.com.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So. We've had a great lineup of guests today, and I want to thank them all. We started out with Jonathan Cogley, who is the CEO of Thycotic, and then we had Larry Beebe, who is the principal of Bond Beebe, and then we had Dr. Celissa Lambert Woodward, who is the president and CEO of Pathways Homes, and then finally John Nolan, president of Quadel Consulting. I want to thank our friends here at Offutt Corman for hosting our broadcast and helping to support the show throughout. And I'd also like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show at all. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, to learn more about our executive leaders. And if you want to hear the show again, you can click on it at businesstalkradio.net. Tune in again next week. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Join the Animal Welfare League of Arlington as they roll out the red carpet for shelter animals at the second annual Golden Paw Gala, Saturday, November 1st at the Westin Arlington Gateway. Mix and mingle with adoptable shelter dog celebrities, sip martinis, indulge in fine dining, and dance to the tunes of Odyssey Band. Hosted by WTOP's Joan Jones and Dr. Katie from The Pet Show on News Channel 8, event proceeds support services provided by the Animal Welfare League of Arlington. To purchase tickets, visit awla.org.
The 14th annual March of Dimes Heroines of Washington Gala will honor women who exemplify leadership and are making a difference in our community. From CEOs to rising stars, this year's finalists will be recognized for their significant volunteer contributions at a Black Tie Awards presentation on Tuesday, November 18th at the Ritz-Carlton Tyson's Corner. All proceeds from Heroines of Washington will benefit the March of Dimes mission to give all babies a healthy start in life. Since 2001, the event has given awards to 80 heroines, and has raised more than $1.7 million to support the March of Dimes effort to help women have full-term, healthy pregnancies and healthy babies. To learn more about the March of Dimes, to purchase tickets to Heroines of Washington, and make a donation, visit marchofdimes.org/heroines. Join them in celebrating these inspiring women who go above and beyond to improve our community. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and Federal News Radio.
This paid